Good morning, everyone. So glad to see all of y'all today. Thank you very much for being here on this busy, busy Sunday. We have so much going on, but this is a real treat, and I am thrilled that you all will get to hear today from the very Reverend Andrew McGowan, Dean of Berkeley Divinity School at Yale. That's a place near and dear to my heart, but as I said to the 8 o'clock crowd, I'll say to you, Dean McGowan started his tenure after I'd already gone to Berkeley, so anything that you don't like about me, you can't blame him for it, all right? It's not his fault. He's been straightening things out ever since and has done an amazing job in 12 years as dean? 12 years as dean of Berkeley. So it's been wonderful to see the school flourish and thrive under his leadership, and he has a presence in the wider church beyond the Diocese of Connecticut and Berkeley. Indeed, he's blessed us all with the kind of priests that Berkeley is producing and sustaining in ministry. So without further ado, I want to invite Dean McGowan here to the podium. Continuing our conversation on Scripture, we ended Genesis a few weeks ago, and he's going to jump right into Exodus as we make our way on towards Advent. Dean McGowan, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the invitation. When I was planning with my staff a short visit to Houston to catch up with some of our alumni, which we did last night, and of course I saw the rector then with some others, we thought, well, perhaps I can also wangle my way into, you know, doing something at a place like, oh, I don't know, St. Martin's or whatever. So, in fact, thanks to the rector and to Dr. Hilden, I'm here having dropped into your Christian education program, which sounds like a wonderful idea. But I'm reminded of this scene of, do you remember How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying? And there's this moment when the book says to him, if you're a vice president, this is the best thing imaginable, unless you're vice president for advertising, which is, of course, exactly what's happened. So it's like getting to speak to the folk at St. Martin's is the best thing imaginable. But they're asking you to cover the whole of one book of the Bible in one session. So this is the price I pay for my eagerness to connect with you, but I am delighted to be here, and thank you. So the story so far, you've been looking at the book Genesis, correct? Tell me how Genesis ends. Anyone? What happens at the end of Genesis? Right, so it's the Joseph part where Joseph has scored this amazing victory by getting close to Pharaoh and solving the problem of a famine in the whole region by taking his family into Egypt. This sounds like another version of that vice president for advertising sign story, because, of course, what happens at the beginning of the book Exodus is we discover that being in Egypt after a while wasn't really such a good thing at all. So the story of the book Exodus is effectively the Israelites' departure from Egypt, having solve one problem by entering into another. God works with Israel to call Israel into a special relationship. Exodus is in many respects the central book of the whole Hebrew Bible. I mean, I'm the one talking about it today, so you'd expect me to make these vaunting statements. But if there is a book of the Hebrew Bible that unlocks to us the mystery of faith itself and the mystery of the gospel. Now, that may sound like a somewhat strange thing to say about the Old Testament, but I'm going to say it again just so that you know I wasn't at least saying that by accident. When we read Genesis, we know that we're discovering things about our own faith, don't we? Not simply about ancient Israelite mythology or about stories of patriarchs that have academic interest but no personal significance. The book Exodus, I think, can of course be read as a fascinating story about the Israelite memory of their own origin story. But for the Christian, it's a book to be read as something about our own origin story. Now, that may sound still a little bit confusing, and I hope that after 20 minutes or so, it'll be a little less confusing. But let me start with bringing us through a basic outline of the book Exodus. So the first 11 or so chapters of the book Exodus give us the backstory of Moses. We move from there to Moses' role in the story of the actual Exodus. The central event from which the book takes its name is that story of the Israelites gathering themselves and all their property and all their unleavened bread. You remember that bit? On the backs of their, carrying their cloaks, carrying their children and heading out. And then, of course, the great crossing of the Red Sea and then proceeding into the wilderness. They then spend some time in the middle of the book in the wilderness where they experience hunger and thirst, and God delivers them in a variety of miraculous ways. And then they get to Mount Sinai, where Moses goes up to speak to God and receives from God the covenant which binds Israel eternally to a deep relationship with God. And then the last part of the book, quite a long section of the book, in fact, and this is the only part where you're going to find a bit of fatigue setting in if you're interested in reading it, and I'll come back to that. The construction or the instructions that God gives for the construction of the tabernacle, which is really a tent, but it's really the prototype of the Jerusalem temple that will ultimately be built when they get to the Holy Land. Now, if any of this was sounding familiar and you haven't read the book of Exodus, it's because of those nights during Holy Week when they made you watch the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, right? This is the basic story still. This is the basic story, although I'm not sure that the most spectacular moment in the original is the whole parting of the Red Sea thing, which was, you know, a cinematic masterpiece, but there are some other points that we need to remember. Let me, as an aside, say, may I be so bold as to suggest that you do read the book Exodus? I don't know what kind of Bible readers you are, but I'm sure you're varied in your experience and your courage with things like that. But I must say, I can remember my own teenage enthusiasm for the idea of reading through the whole Bible. Some of you must at least have been pious young people who thought that that was a good idea, right? It's not necessarily a good idea, to be honest, except with a bit of guidance. But I will say this, that Exodus, relative to some of those other books in the early part, is a real page-turner. I mean, this story actually moves. It's only really when we get to the second part in the building of the tabernacle that we're scratching our heads saying, why did I have to come to the ancient Israelite equivalent of one of those IKEA brochures in order to understand why God had a particular conception of sacred space and movement? But again, if you wanted to be persuaded, at least relatively speaking, about the excitement of the book of Exodus, try reading Leviticus. Leviticus, yeah, see, some of you know exactly what I mean. It was that place where that pious 14-year-old decided that this really wasn't so great and we were going to turn over to John's gospel because at least we knew what was going to happen there and things would happen. All right. A little more time then on each of these basic sections of Exodus. But bear in mind that I'm unapologetically going to be looking not just for the things that are of historical interest and the, you know, the details of events and so forth, which are sometimes hard to make out in these ancient documents. I'm going to say once again that while we can read these books with a measure of historical interest, ultimately the reason to read the Bible and to learn from the Bible is because we believe that God speaks to us through that process. God speaks to us in the context of the church that does its thinking together. So it's not that we can just go off in a corner and feel that Bible reading with us in isolation constitutes some kind of spiritual discipline that's without risk, because in fact we see all around us the weird and wonderful things that happens when enthusiastic Bible readers go off-piste, as they say, right? I'm not encouraging that. And that, of course, is one of the great reasons it's good to be doing this together, because we're reminding ourselves that the story of God in the Bible, which is our story too, is also the story of the church. And I'll come back to that at a couple of points. But let's go back to Moses. Moses is the great figure as far as Judaism is concerned of the Bible, even more so than Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because it's Moses with whom this great covenant is made that constitutes Israel's specific distinctive characteristic. Now, I've already kind of threatened that I'm going to make this a talk about theology rather than about Egyptology, right? Because this is really about us, even though this ancient world stuff is fascinating. But I had to bring you some ancient world eye candy, nevertheless. And this stuff has a bit of a Yale connection, as a matter of fact. But most of the images that I'm going to show you that have to do with the story of Moses are not from ancient Egypt or even from ancient Israel, but from ancient Syria, from around the year 250 AD. The image you can see behind you is part of a synagogue that was excavated in the 1920s in Syria by a joint archaeological expedition of the French government and, guess who, Yale University. And we have a number of the materials that come from this, not the actual picture you're looking at here, but one of the remarkable things that they discovered when they dug up the ancient Syrian city of Dura, D-U-R-A, was that there was a synagogue that had been buried in the city, partly because of a disaster that had befallen around the 250, that the Persians invaded and they had to close up these buildings and cover them with sand so that they could provide part of the defensive rampart for what was ultimately a failed attempt at defending the city from the Parthians. Anyway, this synagogue was extraordinarily decorated with the most beautiful images depicting biblical stories. And at this point, this was quite a surprise to theologians, historians, and people of faith, because we'd all had this idea, or at least the people 100 years before us had the idea that Jews didn't make religious art. Because, of course, you know that idea that one of the Ten Commandments, which we're going to come back to, is that you shall not make any graven image of anything in the earth above, the heavens, the earth below, the heavens above, and you shall not bow down to them and serve them. And because there was so little ancient evidence about ancient Jewish art, it was assumed that Jews simply didn't depict anything. When this Dura synagogue was revealed in all its glory, there are hundreds of images of biblical stories which put to rest that mythology. The problem, you see, was confusing two issues. The Jewish prohibition of images was about the worship of images, the worship of idols, which, of course, was something that went on in so many of the cultures around them, even at this time among Greeks and Romans and so forth, putting statues of gods in temples and treating them as, you know, images of divine presence. But to depict a story is not the same thing at all. And so these stories were a kind of written Bible for the folk who went to that synagogue in Syria in the 2nd and 3rd centuries of this era. Now, you can probably see a little bit of what's going on if you remember the Moses story, but it's, as often, the scenes are sort of put together a bit like cartoons. On the left-hand side of the panel, you see a little building, almost like a temple, floating in the water. And then Egyptian women who have picked a baby up and are holding on to it. Do you remember this part of the story? So Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, is worried about how populous the Hebrews have become and decides that he will slaughter the firstborn males in order to keep them under control. And the parents of Moses decide that they will save him by putting him in a little vessel, which in our tradition is called an ark, which is, of course, the same name used for the rather larger vessel that the Genesis story tells about Noah. They put him in this little vessel, a basket, which is caulked with bitumen and mud and so forth, and sent down the river. And members of his family watch carefully while the daughter of Pharaoh, no less, finds him and takes him up out of the water and raises him in her own household. So that's what we're seeing going on the right. On the left, pardon me, and on the right, we have Pharaoh sitting on his throne, who is sort of entertaining the pleas of the Hebrew women not to do away with their children. The story of Moses, his origin story, is the most significant part of the first 10 or so chapters of the book Exodus. So he's brought up in the royal household of Pharaoh, and he discovers gradually, only gradually, his Hebrew identity. And there's this scene where he comes across an Egyptian overseer beating a Hebrew slave, and he kills the overseer. So this is this dreadful moment, which on the one hand is justified by his concern for the inhumanity of the overseer, but Moses ends up as a murderer himself. So he becomes a sort of an ambiguous figure. But Moses flees to avoid punishment for this problem, and he ends up connecting, as it were, with the Hebrews out in the desert, and he becomes a herdsman for a while. And while he becomes a herdsman, he has his initial most extraordinary religious experience. Anyone remember what this was? Depicted at Dura on that same synagogue, Moses finds a bush that is a flame yet is not consumed. And God speaks to him from the bush and says to him, you remember this? We actually had heard an allusion to it in the Sunday Gospels of just a couple of weeks ago, where God speaks to Moses and said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And this is, of course, a way, it sounds rather awesome, I think, and yet not completely clear to us, that in a way, God is revealing to Moses the name of God, which in Hebrew is unutterable. It appears once or twice in the Book of Common Prayer for reasons which the translators might have to explain to us. But in most of our editions of the Bible, God's name, depicted in as it's written in Hebrew, is simply substituted with something like the Lord in small caps. You know that kind of what I refer to there. And of course, in Judaism today, the name of God will not be pronounced, even though it's there in the Hebrew, but rather the word, something like the word Adonai, which means the Lord, which is exactly what Christians do for the most part, is said instead. And sometimes observant Jews today will simply say Hashem when they get to that point in the text. And Hashem just means the name. The name. So the name of God is somehow mysterious and incomprehensible. And Moses is drawn into this sense of the mystery of having a relationship with God. And of course, what God says to Moses is, you're going to get these people out of Egypt. And they follow the stories of the plagues. You remember this great sequence of, you know, frogs and locusts and a Nile turning to blood. And eventually, of course, the death of the firstborn, which is the most devastating story of all, even the firstborn of Pharaoh and the firstborn of all the flocks and herds. And at that, the Egyptians say, enough, enough. This cheap labor force is insufficient for the price that we're paying for it. Take your stuff and go. And then, of course, we get to the extraordinary story of the Israelites traveling out towards the Red Sea, the Egyptians having, what do we call it, not buyer's remorse exactly, but second thoughts about letting go of their cheap labor force, and deciding to chase them. And then, of course, we have the great story of the Red Sea, once again depicted at the Dura Synagogue, with the Egyptians and their armies drowned in the Red Sea, as we remember with a sense again of awe, perhaps of horror, but also of hope in the power of God at every celebration of Easter. And this is one of my theological clues for you, to the fact that this is not simply an interesting story about ancient Israelites and their memory. Because the reason that Christians will tell this story and claim it as ours has to do with the understanding that what happens with Moses and the Israelites is an echo or a sign or a foretaste, as it were, of what happens to Jesus Christ in his own resurrection, of what happens to every Christian in their baptism, and what happens to the whole of the Christian church as we undergo the transitions that we constantly do from death to life. That the passing through the Red Sea, of course, in particular for the Christian, is a sign of baptism because of the symbolism of water. So we go into the water as an old self, but we come out of it. So more like the Israelites, as it were, passing through the water, not harmed, but freed, liberated, rather than as the Egyptians did, drowning in the water because they were the objects of God's judgment. And Christians from the earliest times have made use of this symbolism, knowing that that mystery of Israel's redemption by God was at the core of Israelite identity. And that so this new group of people, that God is somehow miraculously choosing to be alongside Israel as a new group of God's chosen people, drawn into this relationship with God through Jesus Christ, have also had their own fate and their own promises set out in advance by the story that was so familiar to many of them of things that had happened many, many years before. After they get through the Red Sea, they wander through the desert. And this isn't the good part, let's say, because in fact, you may recall that the Israelites mess up in a variety of ways. And this ends up being a 40-year exercise. Perhaps that's why Leviticus is so boring. It's meant to give you a sense of what a kind of a trial this was. But in fact, just in a few chapters here, we get a little bit more of an exciting version of how tough this experience in the wilderness was understood to be. They're thirsty, and God helps Moses bring forth miraculous water. That's what you can see going on in this particular image from Dura. And then they're hungry. You remember what happens when the Israelites get hungry? What sort of DoorDash option are they offered? Anyone remember? Manna. Manna especially, and manna is the thing that we've made more of in the Christian tradition especially, because when God sends manna, which is described as a kind of bread from heaven, and then if you've, I've already given you a lot of reading assignments, I know, but you know, I'm from Yale, you expect me a bit hard about these things, right? Read John chapter 6 after you've read the manna story, and think about that. Jesus, the great new leader in the wilderness, offers bread from heaven. Does that ring a bell? So in John's gospel especially, that miraculous sign of the loaves, which all the four gospels tell, is presented by the evangelist John, in the fourth gospel, as a kind of recapitulation of the manna story. And Jesus even goes so far as to say, your ancestors ate bread in the desert and died, but whoever eats the bread that I will give you will live forever. So that's another instance of the Exodus story being seen by the Christian as an echo ahead of time of how the mystery of our own salvation would work. I've added the quails too, because we talk more about the manna than the quails. I don't think Christian tradition made so much of the quails, but they're also part of the miraculous provision of food that God offers in the desert. So they're in Sinai. Sorry, they're in the desert. They go to the great mountain of God, to Sinai, which may or may not be the one that is currently identified as Sinai, by the way. We're not quite sure. But that's a glorious and beautiful place. There's an Orthodox monastery, St. Catherine's, at the foot of the mount. And on Sinai, something extraordinary happens. Now, this the way you may remember this story, and perfectly reasonably, this is not from Dura, by the way. This is a mosaic from the Church of San Vitale in Ravenna. Some of you may have been to Ravenna in northern Italy. If you have another Italian trip in you, you're not allowed not to go to Ravenna. Is that clear? There's a number of churches there from the 5th and 6th centuries which have the most glorious early Christian art. The mosaics there are just really unmatched. But you'll remember this as the story of Moses going up the mountain and receiving the Ten Commandments, right? Which is absolutely correct, but I think we've sometimes narrow the focus of that story a little bit, because the point is really this, that when Moses goes up the mountain, he is Israel's representative going to form an agreement with God. They make a treaty together. And the Ten Commandments are, in effect, the terms of the treaty. You know, thou shalt, thou shalt, thou shalt. You remember all that. And we, of course, still consider the Ten Commandments as a useful normative summary of appropriate human behavior, which is indeed fine. But we can perhaps veer into the side of misunderstanding their significance for the Christian, because the Ten Commandments are the center of the covenant made on Israel's behalf by Moses. The covenant that the Christians have taken part in, which is once again echoed in the original covenant, is the covenant made with Jesus on the cross, who takes away the sins of the world. This doesn't mean that we're not called to the same or whatever greater standards of human morality may be appropriate and which the Ten Commandments instantiate. But just be aware of that heresy which says that if I keep all the Ten Commandments, I've done my bit. Because that's not the way that God's grace works. Nevertheless, the commandments are the sign of that covenant relationship. And you've often seen those artistic representations of Moses sort of lugging these two great tablets down, which is appropriate. But by the way, it's probably not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's in a covenant, in an ancient covenant, you made two copies, just as you would see if some great person signs an agreement with another party. There are two copies. This is God's copy and the human being's copy. And of course, the first lot get broken, because when Moses goes down the mountain, he finds that the people were a bit impatient and decided that they would invent a new religious practice. They make a golden calf for themselves because they're impatient, despite the manna, despite the quails, despite the water. Yes, they're an intransigent people. This is not meant to be a basis on which you say, well, those Israelites, they were intransigent people. This is meant to be the basis on which you say, oops, they were intransigent, so are we. God is patient. God will give us second chances, because, in fact, Moses makes another set of tablets, and on they go. The last part of the book concerns God giving Moses the instructions for the tabernacle. Now, this, again, from Dura, it's hard to turn that in your mind's eye into a tabernacle, which, mind you, that's a word that only gets used, really, either in this context or when people have a box or a chest within which the reserved sacrament is kept. But a tabernacle in older English just means a tent or some sort of canvas construction. It's a marquee, if you want to put it that way. But this is apparently the intention of this image, that the figure with the sort of strange garb is Aaron, the brother of Moses, the first high priest. And so we're seeing the tabernacle put into action. And the tabernacle, when they're wandering in the wilderness, is the original place where God says, you build this structure and you arrange it in this particular sense with a courtyard around it and with an inner place, which will be its inner sanctum. That's actually where we get that term, the Holy of Holies. And I will show up, says God, and you will bring sacrifices to me in that place. And so in its original version, it's a temporary portable shrine which travels with the Israelites through these 40 years in the wilderness. But of course, it provides for them the archetype or the blueprint for what will eventually happen in Jerusalem when Solomon builds a temple which has these same sort of features. And you can see various elements there, the menorah, you can see animals being brought for sacrifice, and of course Aaron himself. So this is fascinating, and again, I'm treating it for these purposes, not as Egyptology so much as theology. So let me, having made a few of these points as I go along, just remind you of a way in which each of these sections that we've talked about might be read by Christians, not only as part of the history of ancient Israel, which of course it is, but as part of our own histories and part of the history of Jesus Christ himself, our representative figure whose body we become and therefore whose mystery and whose experience and whose life we engage in, we encounter, we become. The story of Moses, of course, especially at the early part, is quite reminiscent of parts of the story of Jesus. So when a wicked king decides that the young men of a particular area are going to be done away with because they constitute a threat, that's a story we also find in Matthew chapter 2, when Herod becomes a kind of new Pharaoh, and thus Jesus is being signaled to us as being a new Moses. The Passover story, the story which I really barely touched on, but you remember that part of the, when they actually go out from Egypt in the Exodus, they're given instructions to celebrate a particular feast, that they will take a lamb, that they will slaughter it and paint the doorposts with blood, and they will only eat unleavened bread for the week. So that Passover, including the ritual meal associated with it, is taken up by St. Paul to be a way of thinking about Christ's own self-giving and a way in which the Christians should think of ourselves as people who celebrate and remember in the same kind of way the ancient Israelites do. The text up there, for those of you who haven't got the first letter of the Corinthians chapter 5 memorized, what were you thinking? Really showing up today without that? Christ our Passover has been sacrificed for us. You only need to know the Book of Common Prayer to get that one. Christ our Passover has been sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast. Then they wander in the wilderness. Paul, again, in 1 Corinthians, again, takes that up. And he talks about the experience of the ancient Israelites. And he says, our ancestors were all in the wilderness. They were all baptized through the cloud. They were all fed the same spiritual drink from the rock that God gave them. And he says this remarkable thing. And the rock was Christ. He's not just saying that this is a story that sort of echoes for us because we also have experiences of God looking after us and caring for us. Paul actually suggests that the work of God that was present in the Exodus story itself was somehow the work of the Trinity, the work of God as we know God, and that Christ himself is present in those ancient events as well as in the modern ones. The Sinai and the covenant story. The letter to the Hebrews is an extraordinary work. While I'm giving you extra credit homework, read the letter to the Hebrews by all means. This is a very dense and complex, but perhaps the richest, theologically richest book in the New Testament. Next week I'll have to say it's another book, because how do I get away with saying that? There is a saying, by the way, that the only way to preach orthodoxy is to preach one heresy one week and the opposite one the next. So this week it's the letter to the Hebrews that's the richest book of the New Testament, but someone will tell you something different and they'll be right too. But in the letter to the Hebrews chapter 12, and then I'm actually going to treat these two together, the Sinai and Covenant and Tabernacle, we get this extraordinary image that the author of Hebrews, who we don't know who that was, by the way, the author of the letter to the Hebrews talks about the experience of Christ as being like that of the covenant. And he says in chapter 12, you know, you haven't come to the sort of place like Moses did with a mysterious fire or with a voice that you couldn't locate or with these things. You have come to a different kind of mystery. Your experience of Christ, in other words, he says, is a greater thing even than Moses experienced on Sinai. What an extraordinary statement to make. And then last but not least, the tabernacle connection in Hebrews chapter 9, he says that Christ entered into the holy place in the tabernacle like the high priest Aaron did, with this difference that the holy place that Christ entered into through his death, resurrection and ascension is not the earthly tabernacle but a heavenly one, which was in the author of Hebrews' mind actually the heavenly prototype that was being depicted in the book of Exodus so that we would understand what the work of Jesus would be like. So Exodus is a rich book for understanding Israelite religion, for understanding Judaism. It's a rich book for understanding how the ancient church and the first Christian believers came to understand that the extraordinary experience of Jesus which looked to the secular eye, if I can put it that way, like the death of a marginalized criminal outside a city wall, actually constituted God's fulfillment of images that had been laid down in ancient times in the writings of the Israelite people. That Christ himself would be a way not only to read Exodus differently, but that Exodus itself is a way for us to read the experience of Christ. One early example of this, just to finish on, in the year 160 of our era, the Christian bishop Melito, who is writing in Sardis, which is in modern Turkey, this is the oldest Easter sermon that has come down to us from anyone, unless parts of 1 Corinthians should perhaps be thought in those terms. And Melito speaks to his congregation, and he says, "New and old, eternal and temporal, corruptible and incorruptible, mortal and immortal is the mystery of the Passover. Old insofar as it concerns the law, new insofar as it concerns the gospel. Temporal as it concerns the type, meaning those ancient images. Eternal because of grace. Corruptible because of the sacrifice of the sheep, the original Exodus sacrifice. Incorruptible because of the life of the Lord. Mortal because of his burial in the earth. Immortal because of his resurrection from the dead." So you can see how Melito is picking up these notions of how the Exodus story actually provides us with a sense of understanding what the resurrection of Jesus meant. And that's why, of course, not just by historical accident, we celebrate Easter basically at Passover. Because Passover, for us, is the mystery through which we understand that what has happened to Jesus is not simply some inexplicable miracle, but what has happened to Jesus is actually his fulfillment and recapitulation of the whole of Israel's origin story, and that by his participating in death and resurrection, like the events of the original Passover, he too has drawn us into a relationship with God which constitutes our freedom from different forms of oppression and slavery, our redemption into a new kind of Christian existence, a new kind of life, and to journey with him in our lives, sometimes by faith and sometimes hungering and thirsting, but always confident that God will care and look after us as we undertake that journey towards the promises that God has offered us. I'm going to stop there and see if you have a question or two before we have to do other things, but thank you for your attention. Anyone? And there's a mic somewhere which someone else has, I think. Is that right? Please. Well, you either think, yes, there is someone. I was thinking for a minute you actually got everything about the book of Exodus and you weren't going to have to come to divinity school after all. But anyway, please.
How do we deal with the doubting Thomas that will say, well, you can get all Christianity just in incorporated all of this and created it in a way that would work? Also, how do we deal with those that say, there can't be a miracle like the splitting of the Red Sea?
Okay. Yeah, so two interesting questions. I think for the first one is like, well, you know, Christianity just took all this over, and that's exactly right. That's exactly what we're saying, and we're not pretending anything else. In other words, we're not suggesting that the character of the gospel is primarily its novelty. We're actually suggesting that the character of the gospel has to do with the way that it resonates with what was already known and heard. And that's kind of a different view of reality from that which may often be, you know, in our culture, isn't it? Where surely, you know, the thing that's new and different is the thing that might be exciting. But see, we don't even only say that. We think that this story kind of provides us with a map to think about the story of Jesus. But we might also have to say that we think that creation itself and the relationship between God and the world, even outside of history, provides us with some kind of deep grooves along which to move. Both history and creation suggest that the reality of God is something which people have always known, even if they haven't always been able to describe it. So for me, even though it's still a bit of an ambit claim compared to the forms of skepticism that exist among us, I'm saying, yes, bring it on. This is not true because it's new, it's true because it's old, something like that. And then the second one in the Red Sea and so forth, I confess I'm a little bit stumped by that. It's a good question. It really goes to the question, I guess, of the miraculous as a whole, doesn't it? I mean, there are those historians and theologians who've said, well, you know, they've raised a number of historical and even geographical questions, like what does this even mean? It doesn't necessarily mean that they, you know, walked across the deepest body of water that could be found if you looked at a map today, but rather that God miraculously, supernaturally assisted their passage through something like a swamp or something. In fact, the translation, I think, of the Hebrew is better rendered a sea of reeds than the Red Sea as we now look at it on a map. So I feel there we have to acknowledge that we're talking about events to which we do not have access. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be open to thinking about the historical evidence and the historical difficulties. But I guess I'm also saying that there are probably some other aspects of this story that we're not really sure about, you know, historically in every detail. But Exodus is offered to us as a story whose truth has to make sense to us in some sense existentially and not simply historically. Because it's entirely possible for someone, and you do see this going on, for people to sort of attempt to prove to themselves that every aspect of some particular biblical narrative is completely historically true, even when I'm not necessarily sure. I mean, if I'm treading on holy ground, forgive me, but, you know, Noah's Ark, for instance, I'm not sure that all those ancient, very ancient stories in Genesis are meant to be scientifically accurate. But you can spend a lot of time worrying about the scientific accuracy of that and not having any clue what the theological point is. Because you can believe that Noah stuffed various animals into an ark by some mechanism that I haven't worked out, but not understand that, like all this, what that story is telling us is that God's covenant faithfulness is real and that God has drawn us through many deep waters into new life on the other side of a story like that. So we've always got to keep our sort of personal spiritual readings of these things going, even while we ask the interesting historical questions. And I'm certainly always for that too. Thank you. Have we got one more maybe? Please, at the back. Sorry, how the Hebrews
became God's chosen people.
Oh, how they became God's chosen people. Yeah, because God's like that. I mean, this is a very fair question, and I think that Exodus is precisely the answer to that question, even though it may not satisfy us completely. I mean, I think when we read the whole of the biblical narrative, and thankfully there are going to be other people in weeks to come who are going to have to take this part of the problem on, that actually even within the smaller stories of the narrative, we find all these instances where God keeps making these peculiar choices. Why Abel and Cain that way? Why Jacob and Esau that way? All these younger brothers, all these unlikely people, and Israel itself is like a big demographic version of all these peculiar stories in which God indicates the way in which God's own choice works is not by the kind of logic that we choose, but rather by grace. Think another version is when God chooses David to be the king of Israel. Why not someone who was, you know, had better, you know, statecraft, someone who was going to be better in battle than this kid and so forth? And the great line that Samuel says in that story is, "The Lord sees not as men see." And I think that, therefore, Israel's calling is for us a kind of echo, a sacrament, a type, whatever you want to call it, of how God chooses the church as well. Because, honestly, however lovely you all are and however lovely I am, God didn't choose us because we deserved it. God chose us because of God's love, which goes beyond the depths of our own comprehension. And that, I think, is the point of God's choice of Israel. And I think we also then have to add, you know, later in that narrative, how a lot of emphasis is placed upon how Israel is intended to be a blessing to the nations. And Israel, by Israel here, of course, I mean the Jewish people, the Israelites and so forth. Let's leave 20th century stuff out of this for the moment. And so Christians, I think what we learn from that is to say that, well, God has chosen Israel, and that was kind of peculiar, and now God has chosen me, and when I come to think of it, that's kind of peculiar too. But thanks be to God, right? Yeah, thanks be to God. So I wonder if that's our time. Rector, I'm looking to you for guidance. So do we have one more? Okay. They really have got the whole book of Exodus. Or do you have one?
Well, I'm just going to say, if there's no more questions on Exodus, leaving out, can you share a little bit of what Paul is going on at Berkeley and Yale?
The infomercial proceeds. Isn't he a good alumnus? We are proud of him, and thank you for that. Over on the table on the way out, there are some brochures sort of saying something about the work we do. We, of course, train clergy for their ministerial vocations in a kind of traditional model of full-time residential education for the most part. And, of course, we do that in the ecumenical context of one of the world's great universities, and that's a gift that we hope to keep offering to the church, and we're doing so robustly. Some of you read sort of stories about seminaries, you know, heading in difficult directions and not being sustainable. I can readily assure you that Berklee Divinity School at Yale is a sustainable, robust, strong institution that's welcoming about 20 new students each year, and, you know, most of them are heading off to ordination. We're also now working in continuing education for clergy, and I hope that that's something that some of your clergy may take advantage of, because we know that even though we're producing people, you know, who experience will suggest are people of great talent and resilience, that a lot of people are ending up in ministry now without the benefit of that kind of full-time residential training. And so we're seeking to provide more effective forms of continuing education, including a model something like executive education, which I'm sure some of you have come across in your professional fields, whereby we're bringing a group in for a residential program each summer to bring them into contact not just with more theology, but with some of the other resources that Yale has around thinking about managing change and dealing with problem solving and so forth. So our work with residential students continues apace. Our work for continuing education for clergy and others is another significant part of what we've been doing. I'm stepping down from the deanship after 12 years at the end of this academic year. We're well into the process of a new dean coming, and then I'm, after a year away to give them some space, I'm coming back and joining the faculty at Yale to keep teaching in my own area, which is sort of, you may have gathered, sort of ancient Christian things as well as liturgical studies. So we're very delighted to have this connection with you through your rector. I was here last night with a reception with another group of our alums who are working in the Houston area. We have quite a few, especially younger clergy who've come out in the past 5 or 6 years. And we hope to continue to be making our contributions to the work of the church. And it's such a delight to see St. Martin's being a place which is not absorbing any of the kind of naysaying narratives about the struggles that faith communities are having, even though we know that they have some truth as well, but rather asking what would God seek for us to do next, and having a sense of faith and hope and the belief that even in our wilderness experiences, it sometimes seems that there are promises and that God is faithful. So thank you for the segue. He didn't. I'll pay him after, but I hadn't prearranged that. And my thanks to you for your attention and your company today. Thank you.